Warren Buffett, or other billionaires holding such large blocks of shares that they couldn't be ignored. The long-running bull market, interrupted only briefly by the 1991 recession, had lulled shareholders into complacency and masked a steady erosion of shareholder democracy. Entrenched executives who managed their companies for their benefit rather than for shareholders had helped bring on the takeover wave of the 1980s, when many of them were thrown out by new owners. But the lofty stock prices of the mid and late 1990s discouraged hostile takeover bids. Corporate governance experts had urged companies to align the interests of management and shareholders by using stock options rather than cash as compensation. The theory, enthusiastically embraced by Eisner and many other CEOs, was that executives would focus their efforts on raising the stock price, which would benefit all shareholders at the same time it lifted their compensation. In practice, few recognized that the interests of someone who owns millions of shares in a company are far different from someone who owns several hundred or thousands. Nowhere was this more evident than at Disney. From the beginning, Eisner had embraced stock options as his primary means of compensation, and in some years they had made him the highest-paid executive in the country. Eisner often pointed out that he only became wealthy by making shareholders rich. By the time Ovitz was fired, stock options had made Eisner the company's second-largest individual shareholder, eclipsing even Roy and other members of the Disney family. Only the Basses held a bigger stake. At the same time that his ownership was growing, Eisner had consolidated power by isolating board members, compromising their independence, and stripping them of any real oversight function. The Disney board had become a travesty of independent governance. Obviously, Eisner controlled the Disney executives who reported to him and who were also members of the board, such as Litvak. Disney maintained that the other 12 directors were independent, in the sense that they didn't work for the company. But that was defining independent so narrowly as to be meaningless. The most egregious example was Irwin Russell, Eisner's personal lawyer, who negotiated Eisner's lucrative contract and who had a professional duty of loyalty to Eisner simultaneous to his duty to shareholders. Yet Russell was also the chairman of Disney's compensation committee. Incredibly, during the Eisner contract negotiations, Russell represented Eisner, and Ray Watson stepped in for Disney. Everyone on the board seemed to think that Russell was an inherently fair-minded and decent person, and so no one appears to have raised any questions about such a blatant conflict of interest. While less egregious, others had obvious conflicts. Director Robert Stern was Eisner's personal architect and was beholden to Eisner for an immense amount of work from Disney, including designing the new animation building. Rivetta Bowers was the principal of the prestigious Center for Early Education in West Hollywood, a school attended by Eisner's sons and the children of other Disney executives who also gave the school donations. Eisner had named Leo O'Donovan, a Jesuit priest and president of Georgetown University, to the board after Eisner's son Brett graduated from Georgetown. He gave Georgetown $1 million, and his foundation financed a scholarship. George Mitchell earned a $50,000 consulting fee in addition to his board stipend, and his law firm earned hundreds of thousands in